Please, sir, I want some more. The classic plaintive line from Oliver Twist. And it was with this novel that Miriam Margolyes was first drawn into the world of Charles Dickens. She was just a girl, and she's been returning there ever since. 20 years ago, Miriam created a famous one-woman show. It's called Dickens Women, and it's touring Australia to coincide with the 200th anniversary of Dickens's birth. Miriam is a hugely popular actor. She's won a BAFTA, that's the British equivalent of the Oscars. That was for her role in the 1993 film The Age of Innocence. She played Professor Sprout in Harry Potter, and she's loved as a character actor on TV, theatre, and even in the world of talking books. Miriam Margolyes, welcome to The Daily.
Thank you so much, Michael, for having me on your programme.
Do you remember how it felt, reading Oliver Twist for the first time?
Oh, yes, I do, because it still feels like that. It's an amazing adventure. It's a headlong discovery of being pulled into this extraordinary world of his. And I still feel that every time I delve into a Dickens book, which I do most days, actually.
Oh, most days?
Mm.
What, like, as other people read the Bible, you reach for Dickens?
Well, I don't know if I read it quite like the Bible. I read it for fun, and I read it for discoveries, and I'm also reading his letters. There's a 12-volume series published by the OUP of the 14,000 letters that Dickens wrote, and believe me, they are just as exciting as the novels.
I don't know when this man slept.
No, nobody does, actually. I'm not sure that he did sleep very much. He used to walk at night long distances. He was a driven, troubled man. And I think the energy that he had just propelled him along until one day in 1870 it gave out.
Just staying with Oliver Twist for a moment, you're Jewish. I wonder what you make of Fagin.
I was rather shocked by Fagin when I read him, because Dickens keeps talking about the Jew, the Jew, and in very disparaging terms, as a slimy, evil creature, which of course he was. And he was based on a real Jewish pederast old clothes dealer in London that was in the papers, so Dickens knew about him. But there is a vitality about Fagin that you can't deny. Mm. There is an almost joyous comic energy that you can't overlook.
You know, it's funny you say that.
Sort of dual feeling about him, and that's very common in Dickens' villains.
It's funny you say that, because over the summer I watched Oliver, the 1986 film. And I was really looking forward to Fagin coming on, because I had that memory of, you know, the joy of him singing, "You've got to pick a pocket or two, boys, you've got to pick a pocket or two." And when Ron Moody came on with his hook nose and his, you know, stereotypical Jewish gestures, fantastic dancer, fantastic performer, but I thought, oh my goodness, that is so anti-Semitic.
I think it was not meant to be anti-Semitic. People did take it as such, of course, and Dickens sold his house to a Jewish banker's family. And he sat next to the lady of the house one day at dinner, Mrs. Davis, and she said to him, "You know, you've written a very anti-Semitic character." And Dickens was appalled and said, "Oh, I didn't mean to do that at all." And he tried to make amends by writing a very saintly Jewish character called Mr. Ryer in Our Mutual Friend. But of course, there's no life in Mr. Ryer. He's just a dead creation. I don't think he was anti-Semitic. I think he just had the usual feeling about Jews. And let's face it, nobody likes Jews. They just don't. And I know it may not be PC to say that, but it's true. I always think that people like me because they overlook the fact that I'm Jewish.
Oh, for heaven's sake. Now, Ikey Solomon is the man who it's generally said Fagin is based on.
And that's right.
Ikey Solomon ended up in Tasmania. Did you know that?
I think I did know that. I know that Tasmania is one of my favourite places on earth, and maybe that's why. It's full of the most extraordinary people.
Yes, his wife was transported to Tasmania. He was evading the law in New York, and when he heard that he read in the paper that his wife was in Van Diemen's Land, so he got on a boat and went there to join her. Now, look, I'm fascinated to read that you studied English at Cambridge and you studied Dickens in depth right back then. Can you talk about what you were looking for, how he spoke to you when you were a young student?
I've always looked for life. That's what I'm interested in, the pulse of life in everything. And when I read Dickens as a child, that's what burst out of the books to me, that incredible, almost demonic energy of those characters and the headlong rush of the prose and the story unfolding. So I wanted to know a bit about the man, actually, when I studied him at Cambridge. And that's what is also fascinating. Now, there's been a spate of biographies just come out about him, particularly, I would say, Claire Tomalin's book. And in that, you see what an extraordinary, completely unique individual he was. And that's what fascinated me when I was at Cambridge. It wasn't just the prose, it was the man.
We're talking to Claire Tomalin tomorrow, in fact, on the programme.
You lucky thing.
I know, I'm thrilled. I've got you today and her tomorrow. What a lucky chap I am. Now, let's stay with Cambridge because you were studying with the very formidable F.R. and Q.D. Leavis. They were the most influential and contentious critics of their generation. And they loved Dickens. But as I remember the Leavis's view, their idea was generally that you shouldn't look for any illumination about the novel by looking at the life of the author. They were usually pretty strict about this. But in their book on Dickens, they actually are quite interested in the life of the man.
Yes, they had a bit of a volte-face about Dickens, because at first they didn't allow him to be part of the great tradition, and then they changed their mind. And in fact, Queenie, that's Q.D. Leavis, Mrs. Leavis, who was incidentally Jewish herself, she brought Dickens to me in a new and fresh way, and I really learnt about him from her. And they were wonderful teachers. I know people say they were contentious. That's because they were quite critical of their colleagues at Cambridge, and they were right to be, because most of the other teachers were lazy and didn't care about their students at all. But the Leavises really cared about all of us, all of those of us who were taught by them. And Mrs. Leavis, by the way, every term end would cook for us a most gorgeous medley of cakes and buns and pastries. She was delightful, and I look back on my relationship with them with great sense of gratitude. So never take it that they were horrid people. They were wonderful, gorgeous people, and I love them, and I love their memory. I revere it.
Maybe another day we should do a show about the Leavises, because they're formidable influences, and it'd be great to have you on to talk about this. But we better move on and talk about Dickens's women. So we're talking about the relationships that he had with women in real life and the relationships, or the women that he created in his novels. What sort of relationships did he have in his own life with women?
Well, he had lots of relationships, although probably not that many sexual relationships. I think he went to Paris with Wilkie Collins and probably had a few good-time girls in the streets of Paris. But that's something that most men did, and maybe even now do. You would know that, Michael.
Sake, woman, just behave.
But I think that the relationships that counted were the relationships with his sister, with his mother, with his daughters, and with Ellen Ternan, and with a few other women like Baronet Burdett Coutts, with whom he opened Urania Cottage, which was the receiving place for prostitutes to give them a better life and send them to Australia and probably other places as well, free from the taint of prostitution. He was very much a social reformer as well. In fact, he was everything. He did everything. He wrote, he edited, he was generous, he put on plays. There wasn't anything that he didn't do. What an amazing man. But the women in his life definitely affected the women in the works. And, of course, that's what, in my show, I try to display, because they were a curious medley of women, and particularly, I think, the disappointment that he suffered from his mother, that coloured the whole of his life. There was a bitterness, there was an edge to his relationships with women. And he certainly rather enjoyed the woman before the breasts grew. I think that was the thing. He certainly wouldn't have liked me, for example. And he went right off his wife when she got fat and old and clumsy. It's a sad story, the relationship with his wife. But as everybody knows, he had a mistress, a young actress.
Who was gorgeous.
She was gorgeous, but she was a strangely withdrawn kind of figure in a way. Nobody really knows what she was like, and she did this extraordinary thing which Claire Tomlin wrote about in her wonderful book, The Invisible Woman. She took 12 years off her age after he died and pretended that that whole relationship with Mr. Dickens had never existed. And she married a clergyman and had a son, and it was only when the son was himself about 70 that he discovered that his mother was the Ellen Ternan of Dickens' mistress. And he had a nervous breakdown. He couldn't bear it.
This is Books and Arts Daily, and I'm talking to Miriam Margolyes because she's on tour with a marvellous show called Dickens' Women. Let's talk about the show. Mrs. Gamp, one of Dickens' most grotesque women, you'd have to say, from the novel Martin Chuzzlewit. Remind us what that story's about.
It was written after Dickens had been to America, and there's large chunks of it set in America that are very critical of the country. He called it, he said, it's not the republic of my imagination, and he had hoped for so much better. And it's not a very good novel, actually, but Mrs. Gamp is one of the triumphs of Martin Chuzzlewit. And I opened my show with her, and I absolutely love her. She's an amazing, another villain in a way, both wicked and comic, which was his speciality. And written in a very careful script so that you know exactly how to pronounce the words.
So I know, for example, that I have to say disposed and say it like that, not dispose, because he's written it with a G.
So she's an alcoholic. She works as a nurse, a midwife, and a layer out of the dead.
Yes, that was the dual responsibility of the midwife in Victorian times. They had a dual responsibility. They were the deliverers of babies and the dispatchers of corpses. And when she's called, she comes to the window and she doesn't know whether it's a death or a birth that she's attending. And I think she quite often gets muddled as to which is which.
And she was the character who got you actually thinking about doing the show.
Yes. The description of her is so much like me, except that I'm not an alcoholic. I'm actually almost teetotal. But I felt that a woman who had no neck, and she has no neck, would be very well able to portray her. And she was the first of my characters, and she still is. She's the one I open the show with.
My favourite character, I think, in Dickens would have to be Miss Havisham. What's the story behind her?
It's not true to say that she was based on a poor woman in Sydney who's buried in a graveyard somewhere in Sydney. That is not correct. It is believed that she's based on a woman who lived in Rochester, who was jilted by her husband and lived in the house forever, with clocks stopped and perhaps beetles running about in the wedding cake. But Dickens' picture of Miss Havisham is absolutely iconic. I don't think you can ever read Great Expectations without remembering Miss Havisham. And I do her in my show. And when I do her, I feel completely lost in that character. He has made her so sad and so powerful at the same time. And she is evil, after all. She's trying to bring up Estella to break men's hearts, to get the revenge on the male sex that she wants because she herself was jilted. It's a wicked thing that she has done. And yet, when she's consumed by flames in that amazing scene with the curtains on fire and her dress on fire and Pip trying to stem it with his coat, you feel such sorrow for her.
And
it's
Miriam,
the most wonderful piece.
How do you find that voice? Because that voice is not written out phonetically.
Well, my dear, how does you find any voice? You think the thoughts of the character, and gradually the character takes over and the voice becomes that character. I don't know how I do it. People ask me, you know, you seem to change when you take on the various roles. Well, that's my job. That's what I've got to do. That's the mystery of the creative process. But every character has a voice, and it's my job to find it.
But are they kind of anchor points, home points that help you contact a character? Do you think, okay, this is the one who holds her shoulder like this or who pitches her voice in such and such a place?
I don't do it like that, Michael, because that's coming from the outside. I have to go from the text, from what she says. When she says, look at me, and there's an energy in that and a sadness also. And she says, are you not afraid to look at a woman who has not seen the sun since you were born? Do you know what I touch here? And she puts her hand on her heart. And Pip says, your heart, Mum. And she says, broken. And you know that all the emotion of what's happened in her life has got to be in those words.
Mm. Miriam, you say in the show that you are Miriam Margolyes from Clapham, which is a particularly nice and leafy part of London. To the rest of the world, it seems to me that Dickens's London is a sort of satirical invention which exists primarily in his novels. As a Londoner, do you have a sense that those streets and alleys in Dickens are actually real places?
Oh, my word, yes. And indeed, Clapham is nowhere near the Dickens, the London that Dickens inhabited. You see, when he was a little boy, he had to walk early in the morning from Camden Town through the very worst part of London, Seven Dials, a place of horrible people and screaming children and prostitutes and villains, and he had to walk across to the Strand to the blacking factory where he worked. And that was his education. That was where he saw the life of London, unadorned, and he never forgot it. He looked at it with the eye of a child, and that eye, that clear gaze, stayed with him right through his life. And he went on to be a journalist, and of course a journalist has to be very factual. So those streets that he described, they were there.
Mm.
It was like that.
Not just the eye of a child, but the eye of a child who, for a brief period at least, was a fellow sufferer.
Yes, he was, I think, quite sorry for himself all his life. He thought that he had been neglected as a child, and it's possible that he was, and he thought that his mother had betrayed him, and it's possible that she did. But perhaps he was a little bit self-involved, I think. You know, he shouldn't come out of it without censure. There are attitudes of Dickens that require a smack, I think.
His grandmother comes off a bit better, doesn't she?
Yes, well, she was a servant to a noble family, the Earl of Crewe, and I think she was a rather sweet old lady, and he drew a character that I do called Mrs. Lirriper. And, in fact, Mrs. Lirriper was one of the Christmas books that he used to bring out every Christmas, and of which the most famous, of course, is The Christmas Carol. And he loved his grandmother. She told him stories about when she was a lodging housekeeper, and he very much enjoyed them, and he recreates that in Mrs. Lirriper. So he does have affection for women, but there is an edge to his attitudes, and I think that is why he treated his wife so appallingly.
Mm. How does Mrs. Lirriper sound?
Well, Mrs. Lirriper is like that. She's quite a smiley-sounding lady, and she talks about servant girls and willing Sophie down on her knees, scrubbing early and late, ever cheerful, always smiling, but with a black face. And I says to her, "Now, Sophie, my good girl, have a regular day for your stoves and keep the width of the area between yourself and the blacking." You see how he brings blacking into a lot of the stories.
There's a little bit of Pam Ayres in that character.
Well, I'm glad you say that, because Pam, whom I much admire, is from Oxfordshire, and that's where I come from too. And so when I do a rural accent, it's very often Oxfordshire.
Well, there you go. How clear that is now. It's, don't say the time. This is Radio National, RN. I'm Michael Cathcart, and this is Books and Arts Daily, and I'm talking to Miriam Margolyes because she's on tour with her show Dickens's Women, and that's a good topic because it's 200 years since the birth of Charles Dickens. In fact, 200 years tomorrow. Miriam, my relationship with Dickens started with the Welsh actor Emlyn Williams, who toured the world with a Dickens show. He performed as Dickens. I reckon I must have seen it, I don't know, about 1968, 1970, somewhere around then.
And I did too.
It was a fantastically memorable evening. He stood there dressed as Charles Dickens with a high writing desk that he stood at and did all these characters. There is something inherently performative about Dickens's characters. You can perform Dickens in a way that perhaps you couldn't perform other writers and their characters, it seems to me. What is that quality?
I think it was deeply in the man himself. He wanted to be an actor. He always wanted to write plays. And he never did actually write a successful play in the theatre. But he loved the theatre. He was passionate about it. And when he wrote and acted all the characters himself. He would go to the mirror. His daughter describes this. And he would act out the dialogue that he'd just written and become those characters. He was a performer, that's what he did. And when he went around America and the British Isles with his readings, and by the way, he was the first writer to do that, to do those book tours, so to speak, which are now commonplace, but he was the first one. And he loved it because there was a connection with his audience, his precious audience, whom he adored. And his first love and his last love was always the public. He wanted to be part of the public. He loved them. He wanted to entertain them. He desperately needed their feedback. And when you're an actor, and I know it myself, it is the most wonderful thing because you can hear the laughter. You can see the tears. And that's what he wanted, just as I wanted.
You developed the show around 20 years ago, and the first season, in fact, was at the Edinburgh Festival. Has the show changed much over those two decades?
Well, it has changed in one very big way, because when I did it first at Edinburgh, I had another man with me. I had a bloke to do Mr. Dickens and Mr. Bumble and all the male characters. And then David Timpson, who's a terrific actor, he got married and he didn't want to come on tour. And I wanted to go on with it. And so my agent said, well, you're going to have to do all the characters yourself. And I said, oh, I don't want to do that. It's so lonely. But in the end, I did, and I'm very lucky because I've got a wonderful pianist with me, John Martin, and he's an integral part of the show, so it's not really right to say it's a one-person show. It's a two-person show, but only I talk.
Hi, Michael Cathcart. This is Books and Arts Daily on RN, and the actor Miriam Margolyes is my guest. Miriam, let's talk about you. Now, I've heard the Dickens show on CD, and I've seen you in the movies, but I've only seen you on stage once in a show called Realism by Paul Galloway, which was a surreal satire set in Stalinist Russia. And, I mean, I saw that night that you just had this astonishing connection with the audience. People just don't watch you. You somehow take them into you. Have you always had that ability to shine your light into the audience in that way?
That's a lovely thing for you to say to me, Michael, and I thank you. I think I have always had that, and I think it's because I need it. I want connection. That's why I became an actress. I want to be with my audience. I want to explore them. They are my friends. I feel that there's a golden thread that binds me to them, and it's a very important part of what I do in the theatre. It's not that I crave to be liked. I just want to be connected, even if they don't like me or they hate me or something, but just to get that sense of connection with another human being. It's the most thrilling and rewarding thing. And I do get it in my show, and I think I've always had it. And by the way, Realism was not tremendously well received, but I loved it. I thought it was absolutely wonderful. and I will never forget being in it. And I love being with the Melbourne Theatre Company. They're a tremendous outfit. So I'm sorry that I'm not doing anything with them this year, but I've given up the year to Dickens, and that's it. I probably won't do the show again after this year, because I'm going to be 71 in May, and I think, you know, there comes a point when people don't want to look at fat old ladies anymore.
I don't know what to say to you. I think you should just keep doing it. I think you're marvellous, however old you are. Were there actors you admired in your early years, actors you could say that you were influenced by?
I suppose Edith Evans and, you know, Sybil Thorndike, the great old dames of when I was growing up. My favourite actress now is Eileen Atkins, with whom I recently worked in Doc Martin. She's the old lady in that, and she's just a fantastic actress. And I've worked with wonderful people like Maggie Smith and Judy Dench and Vanessa Redgrave. You know, I've worked with some jolly good people. The person I've never worked with is Judy Davis, and she's one of my favourite actresses, and I would love to work with her. But I can't say that anybody's influenced me. It's not actors who influence me. It's either people or text. I think it's not particularly good to be influenced by actors. You have to recreate things for yourself afresh.
Just talking of Doc Martin, you know, you are part of a comic tradition in English theatre, and comedy, of course, is a major component of the output of the BBC. Where do you think that sense of comedy and self-parody comes from?
I'm sure it's just born in you. I think I came tap dancing out of the womb and cracking a joke or something.
No, I mean in the English generally.
Oh,
I mean,
you don't not mean me personally.
No,
in England.
Yes,
I think it's because we have a class system, and I think the all comedy is social comedy, and we have a very defined class system in England, so that we can centre our comedy on that, and a lot of it is. I enjoy comedy very much, but I don't particularly like watching it. I don't think anything should be called comedy. I think it should just be called life. And if it makes you laugh, it makes you laugh. And if it makes you cry, it makes you cry. But there shouldn't be a separation between them.
Now, you've had a remarkable career, Miriam. You're in the Cambridge Footlights, which really gives you some serious comedy credentials, if I may use this word. And then you worked as a voice artist. How did that all start?
Yes, well, when I was a little girl, I always used to walk to school and did little plays on the way to keep myself occupied. So I've always been able to change my voice and do different things with it. And then I learnt that you could actually make money doing that. So I thought, oh, that's good. So I joined an agency, and I used to go round and do voices for everything from carrots to dishcloths to menstrual periods and everything you can think of, and it was good practice and good training.
I can't really imagine you as a root vegetable. How does one play a carrot?
Well, whenever you do a voice, you have to find the age and class and the regional background.
Okay.
And then when you've got those three things, you're laughing.
Okay. So how old is the carrot? Where was it planted? What's the other thing? Oh, it's
class. My darling, I can't remember that. I mean, what the script was.
No, I'm just workshopping it with you. I'm thinking, okay, I'm trying to get into a carrot, so I need to know if I'm going to play a carrot, I need to know where it was planted.
Yes, is it fresh? Is it fresh out the ground?
Yeah.
Is it young? Is it old? Is it posh or is it rural? Is it happy or sad? You know, you've got to sort of investigate the state of mind of the carrot.
Yes, it might
and
be.
And then you can get a voice.
It might be an aristocratic carrot.
There you are.
It might be a downtrodden carrot.
Exactly.
Who was Sexy Sonia?
Sexy Sonia was my only little footstep into the world of pornography.
Mm.
But I don't really broadcast Sexy Sonia anymore because, well, it would be indelicate to do so. But it was just a rather silly... Well, it wasn't visual, I will say that. It was a record, or what do they call them now, a disc. Only I think it was a cassette in those days. And I remember that it did sell quite well. So I feel quite pleased. I must have made a lot of men rather happy.
Oh, I see. Oh, it was a sort of breathy monologue.
Yes.
Oh, how marvellous. Yes. And you also dubbed the female voices in the Japanese TV series Monkey.
That's right. I had no idea that that was so popular in Australia.
Huge.
It was called Monkey Magic, I believe.
That's
in
right.
Australia.
Yeah.
But it was wonderful fun and, in fact, didn't pay very much money, but was great fun. And we recorded it in a little studio, I remember, in the bowels of Soho. And all the best voice artists had a little go at that. But I did all the women. There were all lots of different men. And I can't remember any of the voices that I used. But I know that it has endeared me to generations of boys, because all the film crews that I've worked with in Australia, they've all listened to Monkey when they were little.
Yes, we've all seen it. I never understand how it works. You sit in a studio, do you, watching the film and trying to match the words to the lip movements on the screen? Is that how it works?
That's right. They put a sort of a mark on the screen, which is called a wipe. And as it crosses the screen at a certain point, there's three bleeps, bleep, 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 and then you start talking. And that's how you sync it to the mouth movements of the character.
And hopefully it fits.
Yes. Well, I had to do Chimps once, and I remember Bernie Stringle, who was the PG Tips director, he told me that once when he tapped someone on the shoulder to start speaking, they fainted. Well, I've never done that.
Now, I must not let you go without talking about the nurse in Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet, the 1996 film. I just loved you in this part, and let's hear a little taste of it. Here you are with Claire Danes. She was playing Juliet.
Oh, honey, nurse, what news? Nurse?
I am a weary. Give me leave a while. Why, how my bones ache. What a jones have I.
Would thou hast my bones and I thy news. Come, I pray thee, speak.
Jesus, what haste? Can you not stay a while? Can you not see that I am out of breath?
How art thou out of breath when thou hast breath to say to me that thou art out of breath? Is the news good or bad? Answer to that.
Well, you have made a simple choice. You know not how to choose a man. Romeo? No, not he. Though his face be better than any man's, yet his leg excels all men's, and for a hand and a foot and a body.
But all this I did know before. What says he ever?
There we are, a little taste of you in Romeo and Juliet. There's a lot of activity going on in the background there. It really does seem to me your kind of role, because she's a comic character, but, I mean, underneath she's rather menacing, isn't she?
Yes, I think ultimately Shakespeare closed the door on the nurse, because she's not there at the end of the story. She is removed from the piece. And I think that shows that he disapproved of her. She tried to make Juliet marry Paris. She wanted Paris to be the husband, because that was the view of the world. She was a worldly person. She didn't accept love and so on. And I think that in the end, that is why she's not allowed to be there. It was a wonderful experience. I absolutely loved it, and I'm very grateful to Baz for casting me, because I know that the studio didn't want me. They wanted, I'm not sure who they wanted, but somebody else.
Somebody
and
else.
Fought for me. Mm. And my word, I had a wonderful time.
Well, score.
And I think it's a good performance. I know that it's got a rather strange South American accent, a sort of Cuban accent, but that's what he wanted, and that's what I tried to give.
That's what you delivered. Now, one of your current acting roles is in Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries, which is going to be airing on ABC television, and it's based on the Australian writer Kerry Greenwood's popular Phryne Fisher murder mystery series. And I believe that there's a part specially written for you in all of this.
Yes, I'm the rather batty and cantankerous old aunt, Aunt Prudence, who doesn't appear in the books, but it's a wonderful character. And my word, Essie Davis is a fabulous actress. I think you're all in for a treat when you see that. I'm very proud of having created that role and being in such a good and interesting series. And the costumes are whiz-bang. They're really brilliant. So it's very good that it's happening just when I'm going round the country, because I hope that people will see it and then think, oh, we might go and have a look at her.
Miriam, as we wind up, can we talk so briefly about one of your many interests, which is genealogy? On your website, you have a whole section on it. This is about your own family. What are you searching for in this endeavour?
It's all part of wanting to connect with people. I can't help it. I love finding out about where my family came from, who are the survivors now, and I discover that my great-grandfather had been a criminal. So, you know, obviously, he wasn't a pederast, he was a fraud. He committed fraud and was sent to Parkhurst for 7 years. Hard labour. And unfortunately, transportation ceased in 1870, and he was sentenced in 1877, as I discovered. Otherwise, I would have been Australian, and I am trying to be Australian. I'm putting in my papers for the citizenship this year. So just cross your fingers. Look, I've got to go, Michael. I've got to go.
Miriam, so if you have to go, you have to go. There's no way around it. We're going to play some Handel. Can you quickly tell us about Handel? How does this music speak to you? It's the arrival of the Queen of Sheba from Handel.
Oh, yes. Well, I use that on my showreel, funnily enough. I just think it's got wonderful chutzpah. It's a big, look at me, here I am. I'm the Queen of Sheba. Watch out.
Good on you, Miriam. Thank you for talking to us. It's been lovely to meet you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye now. Bye-bye. Miriam Margolyes, it's been such a pleasure having her on the show. I'll give details of her performance in just a minute, but let's farewell her, rather perversely, with the arrival of the Queen of Sheba. ¶¶